Welcome once again to our program, Salvation History, the New Testament, the story of the redemption of all mankind, how God sent His Son to bring us joy, happiness in this life and eternal happiness in the next. I'm your host, Monsignor Moran, chaplain at Carmelite Monastery, just south of Terre Haute, the entrance of Allendale and John Paul II Catholic High at 12 Points in Terre Haute, Indiana. Our guest, as usual, who prepares this wonderful series, is Ronald Eldred, who is our teacher at John Paul II Catholic High. And Ron, perhaps as we're talking now about the life of Jesus and his many miracles, you might give us a little summary of how we've got this far in the New Testament series.
During the last 2 to 3 sessions, we discussed the Sermon on the Mount, which probably occurred in July of 28 AD. We also compared the Law of Moses with the Law of Love of the New Testament, the Law of Moses of the Old and the Law of Love of the New. And then we looked at some key events following that. These would have taken place in August and September of 28 AD. For example, raising the son of the widow of Nam. Jesus also received a message from John the Baptist at that time to verify who he was. And then Mary Magdalene, of course, comes on the scene for the first time during that period of time when she anoints Jesus at a supper at the Pharisee Simon's home. And now we're going into October of 28 A.D.
Okay, so that brings us up to the dramatic event of when Jesus calms a storm on the unpredictable Sea of Galilee, which is also called Lake of Gennesareth or the Sea of Tiberias. What happened during this month of October, 28 A.D.?
St. Matthew relates how Jesus calmed a storm in the midst of the Sea of Galilee. Sudden storms were common on the sea because of the winds coming up suddenly from Mount Hermon from the north, about perhaps 25, 30 miles to the north of there. Apparently, there were two occasions when Jesus calmed the waters during storms. Once when he was asleep in a boat. This story is told in Matthew 8, chapter 8, and Mark chapter 4, and Luke chapter 8. And the other, when he came walking toward them during a fierce storm. This story is also told in Matthew, Mark, and John. And I'll come back to one of these accounts later in the series.
Well, okay, what about that wonderful event when Jesus cures the daughter of Jairus?
It's believed that this event also occurred in October of 28 A.D. Matthew, Mark, and Luke all give an accounting of this story. Jairus was a ruler of the synagogue at Capernaum, where Jesus had set up his base of operations. And he sent messengers to ask Jesus to come to his home one day and save his dying 12-year-old daughter. Well, on the way to Jairus' home, Jesus cured a woman with an issue of blood. That's how it's put in the gospel. And before Jesus and his disciples could get to Jairus' home, word came that the girl had died. Jesus told Jairus not to be afraid, though, but to have faith and his daughter would be saved. And when the party got to Jairus' home, professional mourners were already there. That was a practice back in those days to hire people to come in and do the mourning. Jesus had them leave the home and said that the girl wasn't dead, but merely asleep. And with only the parents and three of his disciples present, Peter, James, and John, Jesus went over to the bed where she was lying, took her hand in his hand, and said in Aramaic, Talitha kumi, which means, arise, little girl. And immediately, the 12-year-old girl rose and began to walk. We find this story in Matthew, Mark, and Luke.
So we're sort of reviewing some of the great miracles that Jesus worked as a part of this demonstration that he really was from God, and that people could believe what he was saying. What about the famous story that's been interpreted in many ways about the demoniacs in the country of the Gerasenes? What's that unusual story about?
The Gerasenes were people living east of the Sea of Galilee in a town called Gerasa, I believe, if I recall right. And Jesus cured two men possessed by evil spirits in the country of the Gerasenes and compelled the devils to enter into a herd of swine, which ran off of a cliff into the lake and were drowned. Afterwards, the herdsmen fled and rushed into the city to tell everyone what had happened to the demoniacs. But the people were so frightened by what they had heard that they went out to meet Jesus to beg him to leave their territory.
Okay.
And we find this story in Matthew, Mark, and Luke also.
One of the great problems Jesus ran into was he was rejected at Nazareth by his own people. Tell us that somewhat sad story.
Well, Warren Carroll, whom we have referred to on numerous occasions during this series, until his death just a few months ago, was one of the leading Catholic historians. And he calculated that this happened in November, December of 28 AD. St. Luke reveals that it was at this time that the people of Nazareth rejected Jesus, whereas St. Mark describes an event occurring at a later date. One source suggests that the rejection happened twice, so we don't know for sure. St. Luke says of this event, quote, and Jesus returned in the power of the Spirit into Galilee, and a report concerning him went out through all the surrounding country. And he taught in their synagogues, being glorified by all. And he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up. And he went to the synagogue, as his custom was, on the Sabbath day. And he stood up to read. And there was given to him the book of the prophet Isaiah. He opened the book and found the place where it was written, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has appointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recover of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord. He closed the book, gave it back to the attendant, and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, today this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. That ends the quote. It appears that Jesus was referring to Isaiah's prophecy regarding the Messiah found in Isaiah chapter 61, verse 1. After Jesus finished, those present spoke well of him and wondered at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, is not this Joseph's son?
Okay, Ron, up until this time it appears that the people in Nazareth, his hometown, as you mentioned, were quite favorable towards Jesus.
That's true, but this goodwill wasn't to last very long. St. Luke continues the story by revealing what Jesus said to them next. He said, quote, doubtless you will quote to me this proverb, physician, heal yourself. What we have heard you did at Capernaum, do here also in your own country. End of quote. Of course, they wanted him to perform some miracles for them, like he had done elsewhere. After all, he was a hometown boy who should favor his relatives and neighbors. But Jesus followed up by saying, quote, truly I say to you, no prophet is acceptable in his own country. But in truth I tell you, There were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah, when the heaven was shut up 3 years and 6 months. When there came a great famine over all the land, and Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath in the land of Sidon, to a woman who was a widow. That ends that quote. We discussed this story when we considered when considering the Old Testament, and it occurred during a famine imposed by God on the Israelites of the Northern Kingdom back around something like the 7th century B.C., 7th or 8th centuries, the Northern Kingdom of Israel, during the reign of Ahab and his wicked wife Jezebel. Then Jesus goes on to refer to Elijah's successor, Elisha, who healed Naaman, the Syrian. If I remember right, he had leprosy. In other words, both of these healings were performed on non-Israelites. What Jesus said angered these Nazarenes so much that they led him away to the edge of a cliff near the village and would have thrown him off of it if he hadn't miraculously escaped from them. Luke tells us this story in chapter 4.
Yes, it says very dramatically, he walked and passed through the crowd that was going to kill him. And been a lot of comments on that. Was it just the strength of Jesus' personality or his charismatic figure that enabled him to just walk through the crowd?
There was another occasion when he and the disciples escaped the temple when they were about to stone him. He just miraculously disappeared.
Okay.
He and the disciples.
What about John the Baptist, who was the forerunner of Jesus, the cousin of Jesus, such an important forerunner to prepare the way of the Messiah that Jesus is walking onto the stage of history? What happened to John the Baptist since we heard about him last, when he sent his disciples to ask Jesus whether Jesus was the Messiah or not?
That happened about a month or two before, and Saints Matthew and Mark both relate this story in almost identical fashion. It is believed that John was killed in January or February of 29 AD. And as the story goes, Herod Antipas had John seized and put in prison because he had been publicly criticizing him for marrying his brother Philip's wife, Herodias. John had been telling the people that it was unlawful for Herod to marry his brother's wife. Herodias, she hated John for this and wanted to have him killed. But Herod hesitated because he feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and a holy man, as it says in Scripture. However, Herodias got her opportunity to rid herself of this pest during Herod's birthday banquet. In attendance were his courtiers and officers and the leading men of Galilee. And when Herodias' daughter, this is a famous story, of course, Salome danced for them, Herod and his guests were so pleased that when the king told her as a reward to ask for any gift she wished and that he would grant it, even up to half of his kingdom. Of course, he was drunk and showing off to his guests. Not knowing what to ask for, the girl went out to consult with her mother, who told her to ask for the head of John the Baptist. And when the girl appeared before Herod, she told him that she wanted the head of John the Baptist immediately on a platter. Of course, Herod was extremely sorry that he'd made that promise before his guests, but he felt obligated to carry it out for fear of losing face. So immediately, he sent a soldier of the guard to behead John and bring his head to him on a platter so he could give it to Salome, who in turn gave it to her mother. And when John's disciples heard what had happened, they came and took his body and buried it in a tomb. Mark chapter 6 and Matthew chapter 14 tells us this story.
So the tragic death of the great John the Baptist, whom announced and pointed the way to Jesus. Well, this brings us down to the time for the second Passover. And you referred to this on other occasions. Can you say something about this now?
This would have been in March, April of 29 AD, or according to Roman reckoning, 782 AUC, or from the time of the founding of Rome. It was on this occasion that he healed a man who had been sick for 38 years near the pool at Jerusalem, for which he was criticized by the scribes and Pharisees for violating the Sabbath rest. Jesus performed this miracle at the pool of Bethesda by the Sheep's Gate, which was in the northeastern wall of the city. The pool had five porticos, like a porch, porches, which had been uncovered 40 feet underground by modern archaeologists. The blind man had been unable to get into the pool of water, which had healing powers when it stirred. An angel or something would stir the water, and then, of course, all of the sick people lying around the pool would try to get in there as quickly as they could while the water was being stirred, and this poor guy couldn't get there because of his condition. Seeing this, Jesus asked him if he wanted to be healed. And when he said yes, Jesus told him to rise, take up your pallet, and walk, which he did and carried away his pallet. Well, instead of praising God for this wonderful miracle, the scribes and Pharisees criticized the man for carrying his pallet because it was the Sabbath day. He broke one of the 613 rules or commandments, the mitzvot commandments, or at least one of the interpretations, those thousands of interpretations of the rabbis and the scribes, Pharisees. And in response, the man told him that he didn't know who the man was who told him to do this. The scribes, Pharisees, chief priests had asked him this question. And so when Jesus later saw him in the temple, he told the man to sin no more if he didn't want something worse to happen to him. The man then went to the Jews and said that it was Jesus who had healed him. And they confronted Jesus over the violation of the Sabbath. In response, Jesus said, quote, "My Father is working still, and I am working." End of quote. Well, this really riled up these scribes and Pharisees and chief priests, because especially the scribes and Pharisees. He had not only broken the Sabbath, but also called God his Father, making himself equal to God. This caused the Jews to intensify their effort to kill him. John tells us this story in chapter 5. Jesus and his disciples were also criticized during this period because his disciples plucked some ripe ears in the grain fields, and he healed a man with a withered hand on the Sabbath. Jesus must not have spent much time in Jerusalem this time, because we find him back in Galilee soon after this Passover.
So he had great troubles, especially with the Sabbath, or the minute interpretation of the Sabbath. Remember, the gospel that we had today was that the Pharisees accused the disciples of going through the fields of grain and plucking grain and eating it, which was allowed by the book of Leviticus, as long as you didn't put a sickle to it and take. You could always eat to keep yourself fed okay. But because they did it on the Sabbath, and they accused him of, the disciples, of harvesting on the Sabbath because they picked the grain, threshing because they rolled it in their hands to get rid of the chaff, and that was, and then winnowing, and fourth of all, because they were preparing a meal on the Sabbath, which according to their extra strict interpretation, people couldn't prepare a meal, and they said that they were doing this. So the Pharisees and the scribes were doing what Jesus had said so often, straining out gnats and swallowing a camel.
Which is another way of saying they were nitpicking.
Nitpicking, and just missed the real heart of the matter.
Yeah, the spirit of the law.
Well, what about the wonderful multiplication of the loaves and fishes, one of the great miracles, which also occasioned what is called the Bread of Life sermon that Jesus gave?
Actually, the Gospels refer to two separate miracles of Jesus feeding a multitude. the feeding of the 5,000 and the feeding of the 4,000. Some scholars believe that both stories refer to the same event. With the exception of the resurrection, the feeding of the 5,000 is the only miracle described in all four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. The second miracle, the feeding of the 4,000, is reported only by Mark and Matthew.
Well, what about the feeding of the 5,000, since that seems to be the one that all four of the gospel writers talk about?
This miracle is also known as the miracle of the five loaves and the two fish, because St. John relates that Jesus multiplied five small barley loaves and two small fish for enough to feed 5,000 men plus women and children. Therefore, the actual number fed could have been as many as 10 to 12,000, if not more. According to St. John, when Jesus heard that John the Baptist had been killed, he withdrew with the 12 by boat to a solitary place near Bethsaida, which was several miles to the east of Capernaum. Jesus had hoped to be alone with his disciples, but the crowds followed them along the seashore, or the shoreline, getting there before the boat arrived. Jesus felt compassion for the people, though, and so he healed their sick and, you know, taught them, preached to them. As late afternoon or early evening approached, the disciples told him that since this was a remote location, he should send them away so they could purchase food in the villages on their way home. Jesus told them not to send the people away, though. He told his disciples not to send them away, but instead to give them something to eat. And they responded that all the food that they could find was five loaves of bread and two fish, which would have been smoked fish. You know, a lot of people think, you know, when Jesus multiplied the loaves and fishes that they were eating raw fish, but obviously the fish was smoked fish. It was, you know, it was edible. At Jesus' request, they brought the bread and fish to him, which he multiplied to feed the crowd with 12 basketfuls of broken pieces left over.
That's an amazing encounter. Well, since the second feeding of the 4,000 is a little confusing, I'll say a word about that.
Well, as I said earlier, some biblical scholars believe that both stories describe one event. One scholar points out, though, that the two stories have in common miracles that involve no healing and show the control Jesus had over nature. In these two miracles, Jesus multiplied food in somewhat remote locations under similar locations. However, in St. Mark's Gospel, Jesus appears to indicate that there were two miracles. And St. Mark says in chapter 8, verses 9 through 21, that Jesus said to his disciples that, quote, "When I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" The disciples answered, 12. Then he asked them, "And the seven for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up?" They answered, 7. So that pretty well indicates, you know, that there were probably two separate occasions in which he multiplied the loaves and fishes. One scholar states that this creates a difficulty for those who interpret the two passages as if they describe the same event twice.
Well, that would raise a serious question as it to being really two events rather than one. Such a dramatic event in Jesus' life, it has a lot of importance in the scriptures. During our series run, Interpreting the Bible Through the Ages, we discussed these and other miracles performed by Jesus. They were dismissed by certain supposedly 19th and 20th century biblical scholars as natural events. They explained them away in a very human way. What were some of these things they said?
Well, many of the 19th century, mostly Lutheran biblical scholars, especially in Germany, interpreted Jesus' miracles in naturalistic or mythological terms rather than in supernaturalistic terms. And during the late 19th century and early 20th centuries, even some modernist Catholic biblical scholars did the same. They started out with the premise that that only those passages in the Bible that allow rational explanations were to be considered as true, and all else was eliminated. The rationalists tried to correct the supernaturalist by claiming Jesus didn't walk on water, but instead merely walked along the beach or on some shallow portion of the lake, that he didn't multiply the loaves and fishes but got the crowd to share their lunches with others, that he didn't cure the blind and deaf but he used special water and powder formulas, that he didn't cure other diseases which were due to psychological factors anyway, but merely suggested in a clinical manner a cure, and finally he didn't die on the cross but merely pretended to be dead. Although rationalists believe that the supernaturalist claims of Christianity had been demolished by liberal Protestant and Catholic biblical scholars, these and many other rationalist claims can be easily refuted, as I think we effectively did in that series and will continue to do in this one.
Those were very popular interpretations for a while, even among Catholic biblical scholars, and I heard many, many times quoted, even by priests, that this was the miracle of the loaves and fishes, that Jesus got the crowd to share the secret food that they all carried with them. Well, I don't think that's very popular anymore. I think it's kind of faded out. Well, what does the multiplication of the loaves and bread symbolize?
The introduction to St. John's Gospel in the New American Bible states that, quote, the multiplication of the loaves is interpreted for the reader by the discourse that follows, where the bread of life is used first as a figure for the revelation of God in Jesus and then for the Eucharist, end of quote. And I've read elsewhere that the excess of bread created by the miracle represents the abundance of the bread of life created during the Eucharist at the consecration over the centuries.
Okay, so the church ties these multiplication of the loaves and fishes to the Eucharistic mystery, the abundance that is given to the people when they come to be fed spiritually by the body and blood of the Lord. Well, Ron, our time has run out on us, so to our listening audience, we say may God bless you all, always, and in all ways.
No.